Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another evening of Dickens. My name is Jay Barksdale. I'm a librarian in this building, and it's my happy duty, well, to be that and to also introduce Professor Moak. But first, I want to tell you there's, at the Morgan, many of you probably know this, there is not only an online exhibit which features the Christmas Carol and 20 letters of the Morgans of over 1,500 that they own by Dickens, but on election night, in case you want to do something else, at 6 o'clock there is, by Professor Sean Grass from Iowa State University, The Worst Dickens Ever, Our Mutual Friend. I don't know. I liked it. But anyway, if you want more about that, you can look at themorgan.com. And also at the Morgan on Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th, there Miriam Margolis is performing her one-woman show, Dickens Women. Again, themorgan.org, pardon me. Bill Moak is working in the Wertheim Study, which is a room set aside for scholars to read, write, and think using the Library of the Materials. It was, I trust and hope, of a material help in all of this. And I'm happy to say that there are two other Wertheim scholars coming up in this series. David Koenig on December 5th, Theater and the Politics of Style and Great Expectations, and Kristen Levinas, Dickens and the Criminal Mind, December 18th. So those should be good. William Moak has enjoyed the privilege of using the Stephen A. Schwarzman building while completing his dissertation about allegory in British epic poetry at the Graduate Center of CUNY, and before becoming a professor of English at Nassau Community College, that's SUNY. He had the opportunity again to work in the special collections of NYPL when he was curating the Milton show of a few years ago in the Wachenheim Gallery. That was a wonderful show. It was wonderful. When it ended in 2008, he undertook an altogether new project, this one, and studying Dickens. Tonight, his talk is Charles Dickens Speaking in Pictures, and he will share with us what he's learned. So please, please welcome Professor William Moak.
Thank you, Jay, for those lovely words which I wrote. This engraved portrait from the 1890s attests to the fecundity of Dickens's imagination, showing him surrounded by his characters. But how many characters exactly did Dickens create? In 1993, scholar Jeff Greenfield counted 989. The following year, Dickens's biographer, Peter Aykroyd, estimated that there were 2,000 characters. In 1997, however, George Newlin specified that there were 3,592 characters in Dickens's work, and that was counting pets, walk-ons, and other minor characters. Yet, this past year, the most recent census taker of Dickens's characters, John Sutherland, has blithely estimated the population inhabiting Dickens's fictional worlds to be approaching 16,000. In other words, the number of Dickens's characters has risen over 1,000% during a 20-year span. But while the number of Dickens's characters has risen precipitously, Dickens's literary output has remained curiously flat. In 1993, there had been published 14 and a half novels by Dickens, and 20 years later, that number looks to remain the same for the foreseeable future. How to account for the discrepancy between the flat output and the steep rise in characters? One possibility is that there is something unclear in the way we use the word character. Are you in the audience a unique individual wholly unlike the mannequins that surround you? Or do you yourself share traits in common with neighbors that would allow you to be classed as just members of a larger set? There are, that is, at least two different ways of considering what character is. And in order to study the issue, let us return to the portrait of Dickens surrounded by his characters. In the foreground of the picture, there is a remark, an inset sketch by Oblo Knight Brown, who was the principal illustrator of Dickens during Dickens' lifetime, who did pictures for 10 of Dickens' novels. By the time of Dickens' death, Brown had fallen on hard times. Though celebrated in the heyday of the 1850s for his illustrations for David Copperfield and Bleak House, Brown had, by the beginning of the next decade, become estranged from Dickens. No one knows exactly why, whether it was because Dickens' style of writing had changed and Brown didn't keep up with it, or because Brown was friends with Dickens' wife, and anyone who sided with Catherine immediately became an enemy to Charles. And furthermore, Brown, Dickens stopped employing him, and thereafter Brown suffered a paralytic stroke, which prevented him from engraving at all, though he could continue to work in watercolor. And some of the large, colorful pictures in the gallery, such as this one, The Ghost's Walk from Bleak House, were done late in Brown's career. In other words, Bleak House was published in the 50s, and towards the end of his career, a rich collector named Frederick Cousins approached Brown and said, "Give me whatever you have left over on Dickens. I want it all." Dickens says, "I don't have anything. I didn't save anything." And so Cousins said, "Well, I want you to create for me the 400-plus pictures that you did again." And so Brown undertook this project in watercolor on a much larger scale than the original drawings ever were. So this is... And he also made changes to them. So this one actually, of the Ghost's Walks, differs noticeably from the published version in Bleak House. There's a figure, first of all, in the published version. There's no human figure. I don't know even who it is, whether it's Mrs. Rouncewell or Mrs. Gamp. I mean, I think besides you in this room and me, very few people have even seen the illustration. At any rate, back to the remark. In the close-up of Brown's sketch, we can see a clue for answering our riddle about the number of characters in Dickens. Brown depicts in the remark his two selves, the formerly happy artist on the left who rode the crest of the Victorian vogue for book illustration, and to the right, a sickly, melancholy man who nearly died in poverty. Brown identifies these two characters as L'Allegro and Il Penseroso, which are, of course, two companion poems from England in the 1630s about what it is like to be a carefree person on the one hand and what it is like to be a more thoughtful and reflective person on the other hand. Here is an illustration of L'Allegro by Blair Hughes Stanton in the 20th century, a particular favorite of mine, an artist, who also made a woodcut for Dickens' portion of The Wreck of the Golden Mary, which is on display in the exhibitions. Apologies, this is an amateur JPEG. It's still under copyright. Back to the L'Allegro illustration, though. L'Allegro is by poet John Milton, best known to library patrons for the famous quotation emblazoned above the entrance to the Rose main reading room on the third floor. "A good book is the precious lifeblood of a master spirit embalmed and treasured up on purpose to a life beyond life." I should mention here, by the way, that the correct title of tonight's presentation is not Speaking in Pictures or the Language of Images, but John Milton at 404, Embalmed and Treasured Up. You're laughing now, but wait. Born in 1608, John Milton is best remembered for the 1667 epic poem Paradise Lost. In Paradise Lost, Adam and Eve are expelled from the Garden of Eden for having hearkened to the father of lies, Satan, who is himself expelled from heaven. At a key moment in the story, Satan is en route to seduce our first parents when he is almost prevented from leaving the gates of hell by two mysterious figures who are revealed to be his daughter, Sin, and the product of their incestuous union, Death. Before the gates, there sat on either side a formidable shape. The one seemed woman to the waist and fair, but ended foul in many a scaly fold, voluminous and vast, a serpent armed with mortal sting. The other shape, if shape it might be called, that shape had none distinguishable in member, joint, or limb, shadow seemed. Black it stood as night, and shook a dreadful dart. What seemed his head the likeness of a kingly crown had on. Though Satan sees snaky sin and shadowy death, and though he speaks with them, no one else in the poem either sees them or hears them. Neither Adam and Eve, nor the good angels, nor God himself regard sin and death as anything more than concepts or words, that is to say, to which some description may be added to provide similitude. Before audience members start inching their way toward the exit doors, let me fast forward again to the 19th century. Here's a woodcut, the same reproduced on your murky handout, by the American artist Solomon Eitang Jr., who in the 1860s illustrated 30 scenes from Dickens's 1843 Christmas Carol. We had them digitized for the exhibition, and they're viewable through one of the peepholes in the castaway section. Here we see the ghost of Christmas present warning Scrooge to beware the children, ignorance and want. "Look, look down here," exclaimed the ghost. They were a boy and a girl, yellow, meager, ragged, scowling, wolfish, but prostrate, too, in their humility. Where graceful youth should have filled their features out and touched them with its freshest tints, a stale and shriveled hand, like that of age, had pinched and twisted them and pulled them into shreds. Where angels might have sat enthroned, devils lurked and glared out menacing. "Spirit, are they yours?" Scrooge could say no more. "They are man's," said the spirit. "This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Beware them both, but most of all beware this boy, for on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased." And here's a close-up. Just as sin and death appear to be figments of Satan's imagination, so are ignorance and want tools used by Christmas present to make a point about the responsibilities implied by our shared humanity. Tiny Tim does not see ignorance and want, nor does Bob Cratchit, nor Scrooge's nephew ever refer to them as if they were ragged children. Ignorance and want in A Christmas Carol, like sin and death in Paradise Lost, are personifications that are quite unlike Ebenezer Scrooge. And if we are trying to count the number of characters in Dickens's novels, should we include them or not? And is it true that Scrooge is wholly unlike a personification? Is it true that Scrooge, like Milton's Satan, or like you for that matter, is an utterly unique individual? Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. Hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster. The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red and his thin lips blue. Think also for a moment of Fagin. He cowered down upon his stone bed and thought of the past. He had been wounded with some missiles from the crowd on the day of his capture, and his head was bandaged with a linen cloth. His red hair hung down upon his bloodless face. His beard was torn and twisted into knots, and his eyes shone with a terrible light. His unwashed flesh crackled with the fever that burnt him up. His countenance, more like that of a snared beast than the face of a man. If Dickens had referred to this creature of the London underworld throughout his 1830s novel, Oliver Twist, as Fagin the Miser instead of Fagin the Jew, he would have avoided Eliza Davis's censure in 1863. Eliza Davis's husband was the Jewish purchaser of Dickens's Tavistock House in London. And that house was the one with the library in it that had odd shapes in it, which prompted Dickens to contact a carpenter to build shelving to fill out the spaces with dummy book titles. And at the end of the 1850s, when he moved to a large residence in the countryside in Kent, he had many of those books transferred there. And in the exhibition on the mantelpiece, some of those titles were there. We didn't have room to do them all. I wanted to also include Shelley's Oyster, we didn't have room for, or The Wisdom of the Ancients, Volume 1, Superstition, Volume 2, Torture, Volume 3, Ignorance. But we got some of them in at any rate. Dickens answered Davis's rebuke by saying that he intended no anti-Semitic slur and that receivers of stolen goods in early 19th century London were typically Jewish. Dickens answered Davis's rebuke also by contributing money to a Jewish charity for which she was raising funds. But Dickens nevertheless appears to have felt somewhat guilty, else he would not have introduced Raya, the gentle Jew, into the next novel he would write, Our Mutual Friend, nor would he have deleted from editions of Oliver Twist from the late 1860s the expression the Jew as an epithet. Indeed, if Dickens had opted to call Fagin throughout Oliver Twist Fagin the Miser, we might have immediately recognized Scrooge's and Fagin's shared ancestry. If conversely, Dickens had chosen in A Christmas Carol to refer repeatedly to the main character as Scrooge, the African-American, he might have further laid himself open to charges of racism, charges to which he has not been proven immune. But if we think of Scrooge and Fagin not as representing primarily African-Americans, nor Jews, nor other ethnic and religious groups, and if we focus instead on their miserliness, we would only be enlisting them on a roster of similar figures, including Grandfather Smallweed from Bleak House, Silas Wegg from Our Mutual Friend, Arthur Gride from Nicholas Nickleby, all of whom are grasping, avaricious people. Avarice, the mean-spirited obsession with gain, is a trait belonging not only to several characters in Dickens, but to stock characters in the theater. As before that, avarice was related to the humors of Renaissance faculty psychology. Human personality used once to be located on a spectrum of types or temperaments or humors by which people could be classified. The critic Northrop Frye once urged Dickens's readers to think this way, saying that, quote, most of the people who move across the pages of Dickens are neither realistic portraits, like the characters of Trollope, nor caricatures, so far as that term implies only a slightly different approach to a realistic portraiture. And this from the exhibition is a caricature of a character. In the novel The Old Curiosity Shop, there is the evil dwarf, Quilp, who's on the right, and to the left there's Samson and Sally Brass, who are drawn as if cartoons by one of the other characters in the novel, Dick Swiveller, who's idling his time at the desk when he should be working. To continue with Fry's quote, the people of Dickens are humors, the humor being a character identified with a characteristic, like the miser, the hypochondriac, the braggart, the parasite, or the pedant. He's obsessed by whatever it is that makes him a humor, and it is our sense of superiority over an obsessed person or someone bound to an invariable ritual habit which is one of the chief sources of laughter. Humor comedy has an easy and natural connection with the morality play. We notice this in the allegorical names that Dickens often gives some of his minor characters. It is this connection to an earlier allegorical way of thinking about character that drew me to studying Dickens in the first place. And I would like to identify for you some of the bridges linking a medieval and Renaissance way of thinking about character with those we find in Dickens. In Canto 23 of Dante's Inferno, quote, we found a painted people who were going round with very slow steps, weeping and in their looks tired and overcome. They wore cloaks with cowls down over their eyes, so gilded outside that they dazzled, but within all of lead and heavy. End quote. What is it that connects the souls in Dante's circle of the hypocrites to a more modern hypocrite like Mr. Pecksniff from Dickens's Martin Chuzzlewit? It is the language of images. insofar as Dickens exaggerates the features and verbal tics of the characters, as well as their dress and posture, Dickens seems to be preserving an older appreciation for the way that every picture was thought to convey ideological baggage. Think, for example, of the picture of avarice you just saw, with a drowning man hankering after yet more fruit. Or here, with the image of blind justice with her scales. But Dickens is not merely imitating tried and true stereotypes and representing character. No, no. He is inventing a personal taxonomy of physical details that are tied to moral qualities and inner dispositions. Listen to this description of one of Dickens's arch hypocrites from Martin Chuzzlewit. His very throat was moral. There it lay, between two jutting heights of collar, serene and whiskerless before you. His hair was just grizzled with an iron gray, and his person was sleek, though free from corpulency. His manner was soft and oily. Pecksniff's appearance seems to assert that, quote, there is no deception, ladies and gentlemen. All is peace. A holy calm pervades me. But Pecksniff's name became a byword for hypocrisy in the 19th century. In illustrating Dante, Doré focused on the hoods worn by hypocrites to conceal their rotten core, whereas Joseph Clayton Clarke here renders the appearance of Pecksniff's moral rectitude in the starched, upright collar to which Dickens draws the reader's attention in his verbal description. That Dickens was a great admirer of Hogarth's graphic narratives from the 18th century is well known. Early critics saw a clear resemblance between Hogarth's ability to speak in pictures and Dickens's language of images. But the tradition going back from Dickens to the time of Milton and Dante is more varied and complex. While it is a commonplace to call Dickens's characters emblematic, the root meaning of the word emblem as a mosaic inlay is less well known than even the once popular emblem books of the 16th and 17th century. Emblem books were popular on the European continent in England in the 15 and 1600s for their fantastic juxtaposition of words and images. Their words were typically a Latin motto or epigram included with verses written in the vernacular. Well, however, in this case, I picked for the exhibition one in which the quotation from Psalms has been translated, and the poem goes on a bit further than here. This is the most I could get on the page. Thus I, the object of the world's disdain, with pilgrim face surround the weary earth. I only relish what the world counts vain. Her mirth's my grief, her sullen grief my mirth. Her light my darkness, and her truth my error. Her freedom is my jail, her delight my terror. This particular copy was of interest because it belonged to Thoreau. It was given to him by Amos Bronson Alcott, the father of Louisa, whom Thoreau knew. What I would want you to realize is that the illustration is not an explanation of the poem, nor is the poem an explication of the picture. For one thing, for example, the word tower appears nowhere in the poem. The words facing the picture are not so much an explanation of it as they are a meditation or a riff. Here, look at this one, a different emblem book. The images, which may seem to us similar to a surrealist collage, contain elements that indirectly reference some of the ideas expressed by the poetry. In other words, it is just as wrong to say that the picture illustrates the poem as it is to say that the poem explains the picture. Rather, the marriage between word and image in the emblem books is oblique. It is meant to provoke thought on themes ranging from the seven deadly sins and the vanity of earthly ambition to the nuances of political power or the successive phases of passionate love affairs. Emblems after the Renaissance survived a diminished existence in the 18th and 19th century in the form of flags, liveries, heraldic devices, such as this one, which Dickens himself employed on the book plate in the book plate on display, but also as a motif on china and silverware in his house. Many emblematic images persist amid our own culture's repertory of stock imagery, not just blind justice, but Cupid standing for love and skeletons for death, though the use of the emblem in the 16th and 17th century was considerably richer and more varied than in our own. The image of a crocodile, for example, could stand on the one hand for foresight, or it could be used as an example of treachery. Bestiary books in the Middle Ages expressly linked animals to folklore and myths, such as we still admit in common figures of speech. The anthropomorphism of the medieval bestiary book is related to the development of two pseudosciences, physiognomy and its subset, phrenology. And it persists throughout the 19th century with Darwin, who I'm teaching right now in a non-Dickens course, so he's in my head. Darwin himself, in The Origin of Species, personifies nature as a she. And in his notebook from the voyages of the Beagle, describes South American cattle, for example, as being self-confident, and South American vegetation as possessing intuition. Physiognomy, however, had its origins earlier among artists, looking for a surefire way of delineating human traits, whether timidity, shyness, sloth, or pride, by using different animals as the key to differing character types. From Lebrun, physiognomy reaches its fullest expression in Lavater, who made a thorough study of the elements of facial expression. Lavater elucidated how differing emotional affects were represented by every conceivable twitch of the nose and arch of the eyebrow. Lavater was practicing a crude form of anthropology or sociology without any statistical evidence to lend it scientific credibility. And his physiognomy frequently devolved into ethnic stereotyping and racism. Lavater's physiognomy, not to mention phrenology, which likewise makes sweeping generalizations about people based on the shape of their craniums, was popular enough a subject in Victorian culture for Dickens to be well acquainted with it. Dickens sometimes made fun of physiognomy in his writings, ridiculing the way, for example, a physiognomist might attempt to classify people according to the kind of door knockers they had on their front door. But sometimes he seems more sympathetic, having once written, quote, "Nature never writes a bad hand. Her writing, as it may be read in the human countenance, is invariably legible if we come to be at all trained in the reading of it." I am not claiming, of course, that Dickens ever read Lavater or Lebrun, but we might ask, nevertheless, to what extent Dickens would have agreed with them that the inner essence of any human being is discernible from outward traits. Though Dickens had some interest in hypnotism and mesmerism, and he treated one woman for hysteria a full generation before Freud treated Dora, Dickens's fascination with superstition and pseudoscience is closer to our own than to Milton's. Horoscopes are a popular entertainment today, even among those who recognize them not to be scientific. Horoscopes are enjoyable to read because they are poetically imaginative, and Dickens partook, I think, of an aesthetic pleasure in reading characters, not as an astrologer, but as if he were a physiognomist. Nor did Dickens ever study Renaissance emblem books, though he was familiar with Holbein's Dance of Death. But I do think Dickens adapts a similar way of deploying imagery when he creates character types through the distortion and repetition of physical details. Let's look at a couple examples. In A Tale of Two Cities, Ernst and Thérèse Defarge are at the center of the French Revolution and an irrational desire to avenge the common people by killing all aristocrats. One of Madame Defarge's colleagues, in fact, a minor character, goes by no other name than that of the Vengeance. These are by Solomon Eitingh, by the way. Like minor characters named only Bar and Bishop in Our Mutual Friend, or Ignorance and Want in A Christmas Carol, or even like more major characters such as Christian and Faithful, who are imprisoned in the Castle of Despair by John Bunyan's in John Bunyan's Pilgrim Progress, the vengeance of A Tale of Two Cities is an idea as much as she is a character. And this is from a Zulu translation that we found of The Pilgrim's Progress. Yet even Dickens's major characters start taking on the iconographic trappings of personifications. Did you all get souvenir cards from the exhibitions? I hope you did. She was a stout woman with a watchful eye that seldom seemed to look at anything, a large hand, heavily ringed, a steady face, strong features, and great composure of manner. She did not often make mistakes against herself in any of the reckonings over which she presided. And being sensitive to cold, she was wrapped in a fur and had a quantity of bright shawl twined about her head, though not to the concealment of large earrings. Her knitting was before her. End quote. What all illustrators of Madame Defarge have in common in their renderings of her is, of course, the one signifying trademark, knitting. The word knit as a verb appears twice in A Tale of Two Cities. The past tense, knitted, appears 17 times, and as a participle, the word knitting is used by Dickens 46 times. This kind of distortion through repetition produces the same dislocating effect achieved by Renaissance emblem books, which conjoin images, cupids, skeletons, hearts, to render not a naturalistic scene nor a snapshot, but a composite or a collage to prompt meditation. What emblem books do spatially, Dickens's repetition affects temporally. It is a mistake to think Dickens, in A Tale of Two Cities, is trying to tell us that knitting is evil or an inherently vengeful activity. It would be equally mistaken to suppose that Dickens thinks people will be deceived about our integrity if we wear clean white shirt collars. Neither Pecksniff's collar nor Defarge's knitting can be said to be symbolic in the way that Dickens deploys the images, for they form rather part of a network of repeated elements in his representation of character that together insinuate a correspondence between unlike things. For example, another surprising correspondence can be seen in Scrooge's house in A Christmas Carol, for instance, which stood at the back of a courtyard, quote, where it had so little business to be that one could scarcely help fancying it must have run there when it was a young house, playing at hide-and-seek with other houses and have forgotten the way out again, end quote. Trying to count the number of characters in Dickens's work is difficult because of his use of personifications for minor characters and on account of the similarity between even his major characters sometimes to figures of speech. Here, the comparison of Scrooge's house to a lost boy at play suggests the complete folly of trying to count characters in Dickens's novels unless one starts counting words. But whether Scrooge's domicile be counted as a character or not, the joy and wonder of Dickens's language is timeless and enduring. The power of his imagination, which could turn people into things and things into people, is childlike in its plasticity. These metamorphoses often begin with a metaphor or simile that are then emphasized through repetition. Mrs. Myrtle of Little Dorrit is first described as possessing ample breasts on which jewels can be showcased splendidly, but before long her entrances and exits are marked solely by reference to her bosom. Likewise, Mr. Carker of Dombey and Son possesses an arch, feline smile behind which he plots his employer's downfall. But soon he seems like the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland and to be possessed by his cunning smile rather than the other way around. Sometimes the dislocating distortion is achieved through speech patterns rather than through imagery. I'm reading Bleak House right now with classes, and John Jarndyce, the good character, is always complaining of the east wind, which bothers him whenever he feels helplessly vexed by the way things are going in the world. Or in David Copperfield, there's Micawber famously expecting that someday things will turn up. or even in Christmas Carol, Bah Humbug. The repetition of Bah Humbug prevents us from wanting to see Scrooge as a realistic character and allows us instead to recognize him not as a miserly person, but as an allegorical agent, or miserliness with a capital M. These magical transformations are meant to be suggested by the space of the exhibition gallery itself. Designers Anne Sappenfeld and Roger Westerman deserve credit for the brilliant inspiration of fashioning the Wachenheim Gallery into a cabinet of curiosities. Is Anne here? No, she couldn't make it. However, she and Roger and installation coordinator Andrew Pastore deserve a round of applause, really. If it were up to me, the exhibition would not be beautiful as it is. It would be boring. I mean, the three of them really turned it into a wondrous space. They built nooks, they built cubbyholes, and peep shows that were filled with a variety of props, machine parts, a wooden leg, a toy train, relating to characters and themes in Dickens's work and life. The wooden leg, meant to remind spectators of Silas Wegg, is a perfect example of the foggy borderline between the animate and the inanimate in Dickens's world. An umbrella is, of course, the calling card of Mrs. Gamp. If Scrooge and Fagin are capable of turning into the cold, lifeless idea of the miser, the furniture, places, and things in Dickens's books are equally capable of turning into moving, breathing entities. Blanche Street, where 12-year-old Dickens lived while working at the shoe polish factory to be near his imprisoned family, must have been as powerful an emblem of melancholy for him in his adult life as Milton's Il Penseroso or Albrecht Dürer's emblem of melancholia. Indeed, by employing a technique similar to that used by emblem books and by medieval and Renaissance authors for conveying meaning, Dickens invents his own individual vocabulary of persons, places, and things that gesture toward universal and enduring significance. Thank you. So there's a question that I can field or two. Professor Shaken.
I'm sure in your study you must have thought of, I believe it was Chesterton, saying that his characters were mythological. Similarly, the characters that you're citing as part of the tradition of emblem, Chesterton saw as something I think
I didn't want to use the word, but I'm glad you did. And you point to probably my favorite critic on Dickens, G.K. Chesterton, who in his writings uses exactly the word you do. He says that Dickens's characters are mythic, so that really we should be thinking of Madame Defarge as if she were an Athena or Aphrodite. But in my calling them allegorical characters, I think we're saying the same thing. The other word I was tempted to use was daemonic, but not D-E-M, D-A-I-M, daemonic in the sense of like a good angel or a bad angel, like something supernatural. But the interesting thing about Dickens's characters being mythic is that it's not the same as to say that his novels are myths, that somehow his books are about the characters rather than the plots. If you wanted to start finding fault with Dickens, I think plots come to the fore pretty quickly, but never the characters. So, I mean, it's interesting that you have mythic characters without a myth. But if you have a chance to read some Dickens criticism, a good place to start would be with the writings by Chesterton, which are now 100 years old and worth every bit of attention. Other questions? Yes.
In the exhibition, there's a reference to the influence of fairy tale on Dickens. Do you know that he did have a lot of exposure to fairy tale when he was growing up?
Yes, his father had a library that he read before they moved to London and before they had started selling off their belongings to pay for a debt. And the Arabian Nights, the fairy tales by Charles Perrault, come up throughout his books. The Little Red Riding Hood image, which is foregrounded, I liked only because he had said famously in one of his reflections on Christmas that if he could have married Little Red Riding Hood when he was a child, he would have known perfect bliss. But he, even as an adult, when he traveled on his first transatlantic voyage to Boston, he brought Child. In a popular edition in the 1800s was Child's fairy tales that he brought with him. Oh, go on, ask me something hard. Go ahead. I don't know. I mean, I don't understand why. I mean, it's hard to understand why someone had such a wide audience as he did, and it's such a far reach, especially since it's now sort of clearly receding. I mean, I was talking with someone just before it started that I've enjoyed the lecture series and they've been well attended, but I venture to say, without meaning to insult anyone, that the average audience age tends to be on the wrong side of 30, to put it politely. And so what does that mean? It means, you know, if we had tried to mount an exhibition like this, if Dickens had been born in the year 1830 and 200 years later people tried to do a bicentenary exhibition for the year 2030, I mean, would it have sold as an idea? Maybe not. Maybe if Dickens is no longer read at the high school level, and I certainly don't think he is, or even at the college level where he seems optional rather than required, I don't know why he's fallen out of favor. Professor Feldman.
I'm just thinking about the connection of technology to what we were just discussing too. I know there are graphic novels, and I don't know if Dickens has been made into one yet, certainly graphic films and graphic presentations is your subject. But I'm wondering, as we move from one technology to another, how we keep our understanding from an earlier one. So when you show the books from the Renaissance and earlier, yet Dickens is known for being one of the most popular authors in a time when people read. That's what we were just speaking about. So I'm wondering if this use of emblems and the use of personification or mythic characters comes from a way of knowing the world that you would see, for instance, in stained glass windows, or you would see when you were addressing a group that needed to have direction but did not read.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering about those connections as we move from one way of finding our way in the world to
I think there's something in what you're saying. I think those who don't like Dickens find that he's overly simplistic, and that's, I think, especially in the earlier novels before David Copperfield, characters tend to be more polarized. I mean, the good are really good, the bad are really bad, but for me, that's actually one of the pleasures of him. Reading is sort of that, is like looking for the clues, like, oh, this is a bad person. Yeah, he's really bad. Oh, look how evil he is, you know, melodramatic. I mean, I guess that's a taste like oysters or shiitake mushrooms. Either you have it or don't, or it comes and goes. I mean, but I think it is actually a kind of childlike pleasure, and it's probably, I mean, looking at the posters for movies that are advertised in the subway, I mean, people do seem to be either superheroes or supervillains. I mean, that there is something enjoyable in the exaggeration of evil versus good that still exists in our popular culture, but it's people are not finding the outlet for that desire in reading Dickens, I don't think. Someone else had to end up, Professor Hess.
Could you make the argument that actually Dickens had a very small number of characters, and he simply recycled?
Yes. Well, that was what Northrop Frye says. I mean, it makes sense. Like he has seven characters: the pedant, the hypochondriac, the braggart. And if you think about that, if you try to fit his characters into those categories, you can do pretty good. Do pretty well. Although there's gray areas too, where is that character primarily a miser, or is he also a braggart? And it was Chesterton, I think, who made the point that Dickens didn't write 14 and a half novels. He only wrote one. There was just a long continuation, one after another, where he kept recycling what Brown called his puppets. Yes, sir?
I wonder if anyone here saw both the Nicholas Nickleby on Broadway, the original one, and then 10 years later, they came back with another cast. The first one was played for the ideas and needs. The second one, they actually casted people to look as if they were the characters. It was much more than a bunch of characters. So it was a whole different kind of experience than anyone else had. To both cast. And very, very interesting to see that. Are they casting to type, or are they casting for this acting ability?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask also, by the way, we have to analyze how did Dickens become so popular? It hasn't always been. 40 or 50 years ago, the principal Victorian novelist was Thackeray.
Mm-hmm. The question was about changing fortunes and popularity, and how it was that Thackeray used to be so popular, and yet last year was his bicentennial. I didn't see any Thackeray exhibitions anywhere, and it's not for lack of, I'm sure, memorabilia and things in the Burr collection.
Times change. Yeah. Thackeray was big in his day, and then Dickens phased him out, and who knows what will happen. We know, for example, now the Broadway audience no longer likes oral or songs. The Broadway audience now wants visions.
Uh-huh.
Well,
the mystery of Edwin Drood, which is just being revived now and is completely enjoyable, would be a good test of your thesis, because it's not spectacular in the Broadway extravaganza sense of the word.
Is it possible that you could take the same characters and their dynamic relationships and just transfer it like the 20th century? Because I don't think that people are into like Victorian England and that picture of what went on then. But if you put these characters,
Well, I mean, look at Star Wars. Aren't you talking about something like that, where these people are in have these relationships to one another in these situations? I think it has. It's just it's not a Victorian setting, but that maybe the pleasures are similar. Go ahead. Set in Florida?
Yeah.
With Anne Bancroft as Miss Havisham.
No, not on her, of course.
You thought it was terrible?
Yeah.
It had a great soundtrack, Tori Amos. I wanted to have it for background music, but it got nixed, I'm afraid. Not everyone at the library is a big fan of Tori Amos, I'm afraid. That's what Miss Prism says in the importance of being earnest, when she says, something about that at the end the good are rewarded and the wicked are punished. That's what fiction is. that's what a myth is. Okay. I had enjoyed the pleasure recently of being in a reading group, a discussion group of our mutual friend, where one point in the conversation was arguing exactly this point. How is it possible that Dickens' characters are so powerful, they seem so deep, as to be mythic, as to be almost ideas, and yet also so individualized that they're not like to just to say that Scrooge or in Fagin that they're misers somehow makes them sound very sort of like square peg in a square hole, that there's nothing individualized or interesting about them. But you know, but otherwise, you wouldn't be here if that were true, right? I mean, otherwise, why do people enjoy rereading Oliver Twist if it were so reductive? Should we call it? Oh, no?
I would just like to raise one more issue which hasn't come up. The uses of these kinds of illustrations in comedy, which is certainly, it's hard to discuss Dickens and not discuss comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, the exaggeration is part of what he needed, I think, to have these comic figures.
Mm-hmm.
Even though many of the characters that we saw in the illustrations are not good figures, but they're comic in their size and in the fact that in that regard they are really more or less inhuman.
Mm-hmm. Inhuman.
Well, in comedy we laugh because something is incongruous to our knowledge of what the thing should be.
The point being made is that in comedy we laugh because something's incongruous. And that was, I think, what Northrop Frye was saying, that we enjoy Dickens' characters because we feel superior to them, that here's Madame Defarge always knitting, but we can do other things, that somehow they're trapped in this kind of mechanized routine, and that gives us a sense of power to think that, oh, how lucky we are that we're not neurotic and don't have symptoms, you know, that force us to keep repeating things.
Could you discuss, if you think it's relevant, the role of the theme of fate in Dickens? Because having read about five of his novels, it seems an inevitability.
I'm immersed right now in Bleak House criticism, and J. Hillis Miller has actually a beautiful essay in which he talks about Esther and how she, unlike Richard Carstone, is not a victim of fate, that she understands John Jarndyce's advice to respect providence and one's own efforts, that one has to respect one's lot, the limitations of existence, but also one's own responsibility in making things better, but that to trust only in one's own strength is as reckless as to be trusting only in providence, like Richard Carstone, that, well, I'll just be a fatalist and wait until this verdict, this judgment is passed in my favor from the case. It's a broad question, and of course, it's a question I think that finally says to what extent do characters in Dickens have free will, that they are not just mechanized frogs, as George Henry Lewis once called them, whom Chesterton was answering. I mean, because Dickens has, characters have attracted flack too. I mean, someone's going to speak here, not at the Morgan, by the way, on election night, about our mutual friend from Iowa State. His name is Professor Grass, and he researched the Berg's holding on our mutual friend, and I'm hoping he can answer some of that question in regard to that novel, because Henry James, of course, was a big critic of Dickens, who thought Dickens had no ideas, unlike George Eliot or himself, that his novels were superficial, that they were, there's an element of truth in it. I mean, I don't think you read Dickens looking for inward complexity of his characters. I mean, I think rather it's his use of simile and metaphor, which are as great as Dante's, for me, his characters really do feel like Dante or some of Milton's. I mean, they're just very vivid. They leap off the page, and one delights in their predictability. For me, that's the pleasure. I mean, it's the child half of me that I, all the years of admiring Kafka and Dostoevsky prevented me from liking Dickens. Although, as someone once said, Dickens and Dostoevsky and Kafka were both admirers of Dickens, and it's our love of them that gets in the way of appreciating Dickens, actually. So we are maybe sophisticated to our own detriment sometimes. So, work. Okay, let's go.
This is not related to an academic issue. Your immersion in studying this that pursued your curiosity and your passion, how does that affect now how you view the world you're in?
I'm interested in allegory and irony because I have for a very long time been accused by friends of having a deadpan sense of humor, especially now with email, that people can't tell whether I'm saying something in jest or seriously. And to me, that's related to this curious relationship between allegory and irony that I want to pursue in a more abstract level. But how does it pertain to me personally? Well, that's actually it. I'm trying to understand why I'm so funny. Why is that? Okay. So is that a good note on which to stop? Or all right. Thank you all.